Hello, friends, and welcome back to another episode of The Conscious Cloud. My name is Joe Izzo, and I'll be your host. So today, I've got some exciting news to share with you all. I've actually been talking to Evan over at the Portland Psychedelic Society, and we are going to be collaborating together. So that's super exciting for me because I've been kind of orbiting the Portland Psychedelic Society, having gone to events in the past and seen tables set up. It's just cool that I'm now sort of building that bridge to work with them on something that I care so much about, which is, you know, destigmatizing psychedelics and being able to educate folks on the safe use of psychedelics. So that being said, I'll also say this. Psychedelics aren't necessary. And what I mean by that is you can go through your entire life never having done any sort of psychedelic or psychotropic thing, and that's going to be totally fine. Like, it's perfectly fine. A lot of people do that. But if you are going to choose to use these sort of substances, it's going to be great to have some information and education on how to be able to use these things in a safe manner, you know, and I think that's super important. So we're going to be working on content and just getting all of the facts and information and science that we can together and trying to find the best way to get that information to folks. And so that being said, on today's episode of The Conscious Cloud, I sit down with Sam Chapman. Sam Chapman was the campaign manager for Measure 109, which is passed here in Oregon. And also, he is now the executive director of the Healing Advocacy Fund. And so the Healing Advocacy Fund is going to be making sure that Measure 109 gets implemented in the way that it was written and making sure that everything that's in there is going to come to fruition, get funding for it. And so Sam and I get into the details of that in this podcast. So super excited that Sam took some time to come and sit down with me. I've also been on the Portland Psychedelic Society Facebook page, talking with individuals, debating with folks, having discourse, because I know that this is something that individuals are very passionate about. And I know that we feel very strongly and want to make sure that this is handled with a great deal of care and implemented in a way that is equitable for all races, genders, people of different socioeconomic backgrounds. That is something that this was created with in mind. It's something that I've talked about, you know, when I was talking to individuals who were skeptical, cautious about Measure 109. And I said a lot of things, mostly that if this does pass, and it did, that I would do everything in my power to live up to the words I said, which is ensuring that this is going to be equitable for individuals, because I truly believe that these medicines have the ability to heal people when used properly and done in the right setting with the right education and, you know, just the right set and setting, right? The right vibe. And so for some individuals, that can look quite differently. For some individuals, they might want to be alone in the woods on a beach somewhere, you know, and that's fine. I've done that in the past, and I think that's a great experience to have. But what I think 109 really is doing here is providing an experience for individuals who have no context for that, who don't maybe have elders who have showed them the way, you know, maybe they don't have friends who've kind of taken them under their wing, and they don't have context for a lot of this stuff. And so I think this is going to be really great in being able to provide those experiences for individuals. And as we continue to grow and evolve over time, I think we'll be able to get to a point, hopefully, where we can have decriminalization and folks are able to, you know, do their own sort of cultivation. And, you know, I would love to move towards a legal society where we're able to make these decisions for ourselves, have autonomy over our bodies, especially with natural products. I mean, it is ridiculous that nature is illegal. I mean, it continues to blow my mind. But again, I think we're laying the groundwork right now, and there's a lot of conversations that are happening. There's a lot of people who are who are putting information out there. My dear friends, Alon and Becca over at the Fruiting Bodies podcast, or that, you know, they're starting their podcast up. You know, the folks over at the Medicine Collective are also going to be collaborators as well. So, you know, and if you're somebody who this resonates with, if you want to get involved, if you want to make sure that this is going to be equitable for everyone, please reach out. Please reach out. There's going to be information in this podcast, how you can reach out to us. And, you know, I want to use this platform and my podcast to help amplify, uplift, and uphold our community. And I want to do everything that I can to make sure that everyone is included in this. So if you want to be included, you have a seat at the table. We are all equal. I believe we are all one people, and I believe that we can do this together in a honest and loving way. So that being said, Sam and I get into more of this in today's episode of the podcast. So I'd like to welcome to the Conscious Cloud, Mr. Sam Chapman. I'm excited. I'm sitting down finally doing a podcast with my good friend Sam Chapman. So welcome to the Conscious Cloud.
Thank you so much for having me, Joe. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. So Sam is the executive director for the Healing Advocacy Fund, former campaign manager for Measure 109, which was the psilocybin services initiative here in Oregon. And I haven't done it publicly yet. So I would like to say thank you for all of your hard work, Sam.
Well, thanks, Joe. It certainly took a village, and a village is what we threw at it. For everyone who's out there right now that might be listening that had any role to play in this, whether it be collecting signatures or forwarding an email to a friend or talking to your mom about what psilocybin is and why it might be important for her or people that she knows, to people who donated and poured the blood, sweat, and tears that really made this happen. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you guys, because this is going to stand to help countless people in future generations. It is literally paving the way for drug policy and future therapeutic uses of psilocybin in foreseeably the rest of the United States and possibly the world as well, as people are able to do research and we destigmatize psilocybin, but also hopefully other psychedelics as well. So that being said, Sam has been doing this work for a long time. So I wanted to talk a little bit about how and why you got into all of this, Sam. So,
yeah, it all kind of started in high school for me. I didn't know it at the time, but in high school, I was really involved in leadership. So sophomore year, I was class president with a green mohawk. I loved being a part of organizing and leading, from school assemblies to, standing up for the very few number of minorities that went to St. Helens High School. There's a bunch of Hispanic kids that, were targeted by our vice principal for wearing bandanas, and they were saying that was gang affiliated. But when I wore my bandana, I wasn't told anything. Things of that nature. And then, I was in a position of leadership, and people looked up to me, and to a certain degree. And it was no secret that I enjoyed a good social event. Mm-hmm. And so on the last day of senior year, when I was ASB vice president, so I was in a leadership position where every single morning I was doing the morning announcements, every single afternoon I was doing the afternoon announcements, I was running all of the assemblies. I was a public figure.
Wow.
And the administration wanted to make an example out of me. And so on the last day of senior year of high school, I actually left campus to consume cannabis. And came back to actually say bye to teachers. Because there was a couple of teachers that I cared immensely about, and I just wanted to say bye to them. And apparently I had been followed at lunch by the hall monitor and by law enforcement. And so by the time I got back into the commons, the hall monitor and a police officer pulled me aside and they said, Sam, we have reason to believe that you're intoxicated on campus right now. Will you please come with us to take a DRE test? And unfortunately, I did not know my rights at the time. Mm-hmm. So I consented to the DRE test. So I did all of the wacky non-scientific tests that they make you do to basically make you feel like they've got you and you need to admit your guilt, right? So did all the tests. And the one test that apparently I didn't fail was counting backwards from 60 with your eyes closed. And I counted perfectly, but they said that when you are high, your eyes dilate when your eyes are closed. And that proved that I was high. And I copped to it. I said, okay, yeah, sure. I'm intoxicated on campus. They brought me to the principal's office. They called my mom. An hour later, my mom got off work and came down to the principal's office. And the principal said, look, your son's got two options. Either he can get the hell out of here right now. We don't ever want to see him again. And he doesn't get to walk with his class. He doesn't go to the senior party. He does none of that. Or he can walk with his class, but he has to go to a 2-hour drug and alcohol evaluation and see a counselor because we think he has a problem. And at this point, you know, I got pretty good grades. I was going to college. You know, my freshman class in high school was 300 kids. 98 of us graduated and less than 20 of us went to college.
Holy shit.
So I was literally like the upper percentile of my class that was moving on into a college education. And I was ready to go. Like, get me the hell out of here. Like, I was done with you guys 3 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
But of course, my mom was like, no, I want to see you walk with your class. You're going to this meeting. So the next week, I go to this drug and alcohol counseling meeting. It's 2 hours, and it's comprehensive. And I go full truth, everything. Like, yeah, I party. Like, yeah, I've consumed cannabis. Yeah, I've consumed alcohol. Like, and guess what? I got good grades, and I'm one of the few people going to college in my class, right? Yep. And after 2 hours, just coming totally clean about everything, the counselor looks up at me and smiles and says, Sam, I'm really sorry you had to come here today. There's nothing wrong with you.
I love it.
And I didn't realize it at the time, but when I got down to University of Oregon, in the first couple of months of my freshman year, I discovered there was an organization, a nonprofit organization called Students for Sensible Drug Policy. And that the whole motto and the whole mission and the whole belief behind Students for Sensible Drug Policy was, we don't condemn or condone drug use. But we understand that people have the right to put what they want in their body. And so long as they're not harming other people, they should be educated about what they're doing. And they should have that right.
Yep, absolutely.
Right? And so very early on in college, that blew my mind. Because I was a white privileged dude in high school that got lucky. I didn't get my scholarships taken away. I wasn't thrown in prison. I wasn't... Like, I didn't actually get in real trouble. I was just threatened, and that was it. And I went to a 2-hour counseling session. That's like, if that's not the definition of white male privilege, I don't know what is. And it was through that experience and finding Students for Sensible Drug Policy and really understanding what prohibition was, and how it affected certain people. And I realized a lot of those people were my friends. And I realized that right there and then, playing any role that I could in reforming outdated draconian drug laws was something I wanted to do for the rest of my life, regardless of like whether it was how I made money or whether it was just something I wanted to do. It didn't matter. Like, that's what I was going to do. And so in college, I, you know, started organizing and became a drug policy reformer, from holding panels and seminars on campus about how to deal with police encounters, because kids were doing that every single weekend on and off campus, and no one knew their rights, right? Just like I didn't know my rights.
Yeah.
To what happens when you mix MDMA and alcohol together. A lot of people don't want to hear about that, but guess what? Kids are doing MDMA and alcohol every single weekend in college, and they're doing it, and they know nothing about the interactions between those drugs.
Yeah.
And so it really just became, you know, from the spectrum of harm reduction to medical cannabis advocacy. I met some medical cannabis patients that were the poster children of who really needs medical cannabis. Like, they needed it to live. And I just found my place. And I found my passion. And I found my voice within that passion. And the rest is history. Yeah. And so that's really what got me involved. You know, I got started in medical cannabis activism, like I said, early on in college. I was swooped up by some medical cannabis activists who saw my work through Students for Sensible Drug Policy. And they said, hey, like, this is like, this young energetic kid has something going here. And that's where I really found my niche, which was at the intersection of passionate activists who knew what they wanted, but maybe they didn't necessarily know how to interact within the political system. And on the other side, the decision makers and the electeds who certainly didn't really know how to work with the passionate activists because they didn't necessarily have to.
Yeah.
Right. And so ever since, I've stood somewhere in that intersection and helping translate and bring things to fruition and really helping those decision makers understand that, like, okay, like, maybe you don't like how these people look or the way that they express their opinions, but they're on the right side of history.
Yeah.
And it's you who work for them at the end of the day. Mm. And so really helping, you know, tie those things together, I think, has just been like the joy and passion of my life to be able to commit my time in so many different avenues within drug policy reform, from medical cannabis to harm reduction to safe consumption spaces in Portland to, psychedelic policy reform. That paved my path. And so I feel very grateful and humbled and privileged to not only get to say that, you know, I work on drug policy reform 24/7, but, you know, I work on things that get to help people and that I care about. And I found a way to make a living doing that. And so, like, in my mind, that's three boxes that if you can check those three boxes, you're going to be a happy human. And I feel just so grateful to be able to play a small role in continuing to push the envelope on progressive drug policy from here in Oregon and across the country and hopefully around the world.
That is amazing. What a great story. And so thank you for, you know, the time and effort you put into it. And, you know, cause again, when you kind of come to a crossroads and an experience like that, like you said, you kind of have choices in what you can do. And that experience you had kind of allowed you to take a step back and look at, you know, like how you're being treated and how others are being treated, and then use that to build, you know, what would become your passion in life, you know? And so I think it's awesome, you know, that you've been able to work on so many amazing projects. And, you know, honestly, when I had first come to the party at Becca's place, which I think I saw you post something online. So really, you're the thing that roped me into this. And then listening to you talk, it's like inspiring, you know, when we were at the Dosed movie, and like, it put me, that's not really my comfort zone, you know, like I had to find like what, like in activism or campaigning, this, because this is the first campaign that I've worked on, you know, honestly, like it's putting yourself out there to a degree, you know, working on these sort of things. And like, at least in my mind, there's fear around it, right? Just like, what are people going to think I'm weird, or this stuff's illegal, or like, you just, and being like, realizing that you do believe in it and that there's science there. And I've had my own personal healing experiences, and I've benefited so greatly with my own personal mental health. And I think everybody should have the choice, you know, like you're saying, like everyone should have the choice for them and the information. People should be educated, and we should talk about what the truth is, especially at this point in time in life where people's perspectives, everything is so strange right now. And I think it's important that we get down to like the facts, you know, the facts, the science, the thing, you know, when everybody is at a point in time where they're questioning everything, I think it's really important that we start to build a new foundation based in truth. Because, you know, ultimately, when you look at how these drug laws got passed initially, it's rooted in racism and white supremacy. And, you know, all of that, I think, has been known, but it's becoming very apparent and coming to light. And I think we need to directly interface with that. You know, one quote that's been kind of in my mind that I've heard a lot of politicians say is, this is not our America. And I'm like, no, this is our America. Our America is founded like the creation of police.
Yeah, you're just in denial.
Yeah, you're in denial of it, or it's uncomfortable, or maybe you didn't quite see it. You know, some of those workforces are the same that burn crosses. Like Rage Against the Machine said it. It's like this. We've talked about it for a long time. People didn't want to hear it, and I think it's kind of come to a head now where it's blaringly apparent to everybody, and you kind of just like either support that system or you don't. And I don't support that system. You obviously don't support that system. And so what we have here is an opportunity to, you can't build a house on a faulty foundation, not one that's going to be equitable for all individuals. You can build a house that will eventually, people are going to come and spray paint it and like literally tear it down. And so these systems are being torn down right now. You know, I'm not a violent person, so there's certain things that I'm not going to go participate. But again, I'm not going to condemn anybody for what actions they want to take, because you have to deal with and bear the karmic consequences of your own actions, you know. But that being said, we can focus on what we do want to see in this universe, which, you know, you have, you know, like when you laser point focus on something, which is like, I like drug policy reform is broad, but then you kind of zero in and you're able to get these victories. You're able to get this 109 victory. And now that work that you've done has put you into a new position where you are working for the Healing Advocacy Fund. So could you maybe talk a little bit about what your new position is?
Yeah, definitely. So the Healing Advocacy Fund is a new nonprofit that is, to a certain extent, an extension of Measure 109, right? So the primary focus is twofold of the Healing Advocacy Fund. Number one is to protect the intent and the spirit of Measure 109 as passed by Oregon voters over the next 2 years during the implementation period. For those who don't know, no licenses are going to be issued for at least 2 years, right? And trust me, I hear the groans out there, right? Like, it's not fast enough for me either. And as the first state to create a psilocybin therapy program, it's all eyes on us. Whatever happens here in Oregon over the next 2 years will inherently have ripple effects across the country and around the world for what the future of psilocybin and psychedelic therapy is going to look like for everyone. So we take that responsibility incredibly seriously in going first. And that's why Tom and now the late Sheree, which we should definitely give an ode to here in a second, decided that 2 years was what was necessary. And, you know, it's really important that people understand that this is incredibly delicate dance right now. And so, you know, not only, so that's the first thing. The second thing is that the legislature needs to provide the funding for implementation, like the OHA staff and like the people and the committees and maybe the subcommittees that are going to be created, which I'm sure we'll get into in a little bit. There needs to be funding for that. And so we have a really good first step out of the gate in that Measure 109 was included in the Governor Brown's recommended budget, right? So every, I think, 2 years, right before the legislative session, the governor comes out with, here are my priorities. Here are the things I want you, the legislature, to prioritize from a budgetary perspective. And so Measure 109 was included in that. She allocated she wants to see $5.6 million for the first 2 years of implementation. Cool. And that's going to allow a lot of different things to happen. Now, here's the thing. That is not guaranteed. There are plenty of people out there that would say that, you know, the governor's recommended budget is great, but like it's a work of fiction compared to like when we get in the legislature and it's something else, right? So
it's just a recommendation.
It's just a recommendation, okay. Right? But you know, we do have a Democratic, you know, controlled House and Senate, and so you know it's a really good first step, and it shows that, you know, elected officials are not afraid to support something like this anymore, even though Oregon voters passed it with 56%, right? Like, yeah. And we should definitely talk about what that means. But, you know, it really goes to show, and all the conversations we've been having in the legislature are really good too. They love the two-year implementation period. That makes them feel like they don't need to worry about anything right now, which is what needs to happen, because they don't. Like most of them,
going on,
you know, they'll be lucky if they saw a couple of our commercials during the campaign. So like they're like 30 to 60 seconds of education is like their basis. Right. So we very much need to continue to educate. And I think that that's one of the things I would implore anyone listening to this who wants to see the most accessible, affordable, equitable psilocybin therapy program that we can create, continue to educate. We are not done yet. In fact, we're really just getting started.
Yeah.
Because now we have to really protect what we've passed. And we have a lot of really big homework assignments, right? Talking about creating equitable access is like just words in hot air for the most part. Like, it's time for us to put our money where our mouth is, literally and figuratively, in all the ways. And so, you know, I'm really excited to be in the new position that I'm in, and really excited to be a resource for the governor's office, for the Oregon Health Authority, for the Psilocybin Advisory Board that'll be appointed sometime in the beginning of February by the governor's office. And so we'll know who's making up that board. And hopefully they're going to create subcommittees as well to really focus in on specific areas, right? Like, the first subcommittee I want to see is, you know, equity and access, right? Like, if we're not talking about that first, like, what do we do this for at the end of the day?
Exactly. Yeah. And that's something that I, you know, I have gone into combat with some people on some of these Facebook groups.
And Joe lived in the comment section for a couple of months. For those who don't know, bless his heart.
Yeah. I mean, you guys are like, I don't believe in winning or losing when it comes to conversations, but I definitely did not stop talking to people. You know, so I, you know, it's easy to engage the people who already agree with you. So I wanted to engage the folks that didn't agree with us who, you know, I agree with a lot of their perspectives, which is they want full decriminalization or legalization. Like, sure, I think
most of them are totally valid.
Yeah, right? I agree. We agree with you. But it still doesn't create safe access, and it doesn't do anything for equity at all. It just, you can go pick stuff outside and you're not going to get arrested. Okay, that's great. But that doesn't do anything for anybody. It doesn't set any infrastructure. And so my point being that I told those people that I was going to do everything that I could to make sure that it was equitable. So now I have to live up to the words that I said. So, you know, making this podcast, having these conversations on it, sharing this information and continuing to be a part of this whole entire thing, because it's something that's very dear to me. And what I urge people to do is to get involved, like you said, get educated and come be a part of it. You know, we can't, it takes everyone to make this sort of thing happen. And if you have an idea or an opinion, it's just as valid as anybody else. And so that's one thing that I've said to everybody. It's what Tom would always say, is we could unify. We don't have to be separate entities. There doesn't need to be factions. Like, if anything psilocybin has taught me is that we are one unit. And so it's just so, it's not disheartening, but it's just tough to deal with that energy or animosity in a psychedelic community where I feel so strongly that we could come together and everyone can bring something to the table and we can make the very best thing possible. But if you just talk about what you don't want, you'll just continue to get more of what you don't want instead of talking about the solutions that we can make now that this has been passed. And I think for a lot of folks, having be passed, and now that it's becoming a thing, it's like, well, you know, do you want to come sit down at the table now? You know,
right? Yeah, no, and I would encourage anyone and everyone. First and foremost, I don't have the URL in front of me, but if you just probably Google Oregon Health Authority psilocybin, they have their psilocybin page up now, so cool. You can sign up for the email newsletters. That's where you're going to be the first to find out of any public notices, the first meetings, the agendas, public comment periods. There's going to be many of them right over the next 2 years, and other opportunities to get involved and be a part of this, right? Like, yeah. We need as many people at this table as possible. And I really encourage folks that if you're excited, get involved. If you're pissed off, get involved. If you don't care, then I guess you don't care and you're probably not listening to this podcast in the first place. But there's going to be a lot of opportunities to get involved. And again, what we create here in Oregon is going to continue to pave the path around the rest of the country and the world. And the trajectory and the timeline in which that's happening, like, holy cow, it's happening way faster than cannabis ever did. Like, I think Measure 109 got a higher yes vote than legalization did in a president. And I guess it was an off-year presidential election, but still, if you would have told me that was the future 2 years ago, I'd be like, get out of here.
Yeah,
right? Even no way. Like, 15 counties voted in favor of Measure 109. 15.
Out of how many?
I think it's 32, just under half of all Oregon counties. Like, if you look at the legalization county map, it's like four counties voted yes.
That's funny.
Right? So I think we really are starting to see a change in public opinion, and we're really starting to see, you know, not just like psychedelic therapy, et cetera, but drug policy reform and social justice and racial justice really, well, maybe not so much racial justice, but like drug policy reform transcend partisan politics. I sure hope social and racial justice at some point transcends partisan politics. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem like that's going to happen anytime in the immediate future, but we'll get there hopefully eventually.
Yeah.
But drug policy in general, like, just like we said during the campaign, we all know someone who's suffering from depression, anxiety, addiction, if not ourselves.
Yeah.
Right? And so when you can hit home for people like that, they tend to forget about their bias a little more. They don't let it go, as they shouldn't, right? Mm-hmm. That's there for a reason. And if you're not checking in with that root foundation, then you may never get to the cause, right? And
yeah.
So it's that's important work, integration, preparation work for you to do outside of a, you know, a therapy session. But yeah, it's the future is super exciting. It's ours to take and it's ours to lose. And so that's why we're being very serious and straightforward about exactly what it is that we have to do over the next 2 years.
Definitely. Yeah. And like you had mentioned earlier, big thanks to Tom and to Cherie as well for the hard work that they did, bringing this whole thing in to fruition and kind of dreaming it up and getting people excited and motivated and funding. You know, I mean, they did so much, and Cherie just recently passed away a couple weeks ago, kind of unexpectedly. So I just want to say thank you to her, and thank you for all that you've done for this campaign. And fortunately, well, it passed. And
she got to see it pass.
She got to see it pass, which is beautiful. Yeah. And her energy will live on whenever somebody talks about her and brings it up and remembers her. And it will live in the hearts of all of us as we continue to move forward with her in mind. And hopefully that's another thing that will help unify folks, realizing how temporary and unknown the world truly is.
Amen.
Yeah, you never know when you're gonna go, and everything is so strange right now, and we need to come together and love one another. I will say it probably on every podcast that I make. It's just the truth, man. And you know, as different as we all have our own aperture, you know, we all have our own eyes and we all see things differently. It doesn't matter if you're tall or short. I mean, literally you see the world entirely differently. If you're colorblind, it looks totally different. If you're deaf, it sounds totally different. So everyone has their own, you know, perception of everything that's going on. And they're all, you know, they're all, yeah, everyone has their own right to be and their own right to be as themselves. And so just finding the things that we can share together more than set us apart is just really important, you know. So as you're rolling this out, so you said there's a 2 year developmental period, and during that time, so what other stuff is going to be happening, you know, and I guess how are you guys trying to ensure the equitability of this, or
Yeah. So as far as rulemaking goes, for folks who may not be familiar with what the setup is for that, the Oregon Health Authority at the end of the day has final say on rules and regulations. Now, obviously, they still have to adhere what is in statute. And so statute is state law, that is Measure 109 as we passed it. And so, for example, the Oregon Health Authority can't ban the use of the natural substance of psilocybin. Tom and Cherie had the vision to include that, to protect and give a nod to the indigenous and cultural uses of psilocybin. Like, there is not ever going to be a time in history where Oregon is going to move to a synthetic only product, right? So like, boom, got it. You know, there's caps on licensing, right? So, and that's not going to prevent big interests that are only interested in money from coming in. Sorry. Like, if you think that's possible, like, you're not living in the capitalist economy that I think we all live in. And like, it's unfortunate. It sucks. And that's part of the reality. However, Tom and Sheree did have the foresight to put some protections in from like a complete monopolization. So no individual or company can have more than 5 service centers or more than 1 production license, right? So that's another one. Again, is it perfect? No. Is it a good protection measure? Hell yeah. So there's some things like that that can't be changed unless the legislature changes them, which, again, part of my job is to ensure that they feel good about what we are doing in the rulemaking process and that they fund the implementation period. And thanks for playing, and we'll come back later if you have concerns, right? But the rulemaking process is really going to be where everything's at. That's going to be the Oregon Health Authority and the Psilocybin Advisory Board. That's made up of many different individuals with a lot of different experiences, right? So, you know, there's a reserved seat for a federally recognized Indian tribe representative. There's a seat for an MD. There's a seat for someone on an OHA committee that has experience in palliative care, right? There's a seat for a member of the public. Tom Eckert will be on the Psilocybin Advisory Board. There's a seat for people who have experience in harm reduction. There's a seat for, other psychologists and psychotherapists, things of that nature. So the first step here is the governor is going to appoint the Psilocybin Advisory Board. I think it's going to happen sometime around the beginning of February. I can tell you that the governor's office has received hundreds of applications to serve, and that despite that, I'm sure at least half of those are from people out of state. Heavy preference will be given to Oregon residents, I think, for obvious reasons, right? The only time where they're probably going to pick someone that is not from Oregon is if there's no other qualified candidate for that seat. I can personally tell you, I have talked with at least 2 or 3 incredibly qualified people for every single seat that they're trying to fill.
Awesome.
So I think it's going to be predominantly a very Oregon resident forward type of board, which is great. Yep. I think we've seen a lot of other implementations that pull from other interests that are kind of questionable, but I feel really good about the direction that it's heading in terms of the board makeup itself. So that's the first thing. The board will be announced sometime the first time of February. And then the board and the Oregon Health Authority have too much time, in my opinion. So hopefully they'll advance the timeline, but they have several months to start to compile and make publicly available all of the available research right now in psilocybin. So that's studies that have already happened, and that's ongoing studies, which I think is going to be really exciting because, frankly, I'm sure there's some people out there. And if you're one of these people, like, please share this information with us because we can help accelerate this timeline. I don't think it's going to take that long to compile that research. Like, you know, there's probably, 40-ish studies, I think, that you can find right now online, and probably another 20 or so that are in process or like are looking for grant funding to get going, right? So that really shouldn't take that long. So essentially compile all the research, and the purpose there is to make sure everyone's starting from the same foundation, right? Like, if we're all thinking we know what the facts are and the science is around psilocybin, but we're just going off of opinion, like, we're nowhere, right? So especially forcing folks who maybe aren't as well versed, right? There could be people that are appointed that don't know that much about psilocybin, right? So providing this starter, not just for the board members, but for the Oregon Health Authority as well, and that we're all starting from the same place. So when we get started on the actual work, we're not talking about differences of opinion or like, you know, measure 109 passed. Like, we're beyond should we.
Yeah.
How are we going to is the next question. And so I think, you know, once that's done, and sometime in between there, hopefully they're going to start to identify different areas in which we need to pull in more expertise, right? And so, you know, again, as I mentioned before, I would really like to see subcommittees created. I would like to see subcommittees created on equity and affordability and access. I would like to see subcommittees created for palliative care and terminally ill patients. I would like to see potentially a veteran subcommittee created that can talk about the benefits of group therapy. And how group and, you know, shit, maybe that actually dovetails into equity, right? Group therapy stands to lower the cost, right? If you allow more people to have access, then that's one of the many potential ways that can fit together in the larger puzzle of what do we mean and what does it look like to really provide equitable and affordable access? And that is easier said than done, right? Mm-hmm. we live in a time in which most people who really need access to regular healthcare will never have access to it.
Yeah.
So it's not lost on us about what we're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? We're talking about creating a paradigm for access to psilocybin therapy that does not currently exist for regular healthcare. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, so it's like, why would people trust it? You know what I mean? The system has, you know, not been great to them so far. The Oregon Health Authority maybe hasn't been great to them so far. The healthcare that maybe they can't afford isn't great. So why would these people, you know, think that the government is just going to start hooking them up with psilocybin-assisted therapy? You know, not even necessarily hooking them up, but then it's like, okay, so I do get free access, but maybe that's not as good as the other stuff that people are getting. And so I really think that the whole sliding scale option is great, but I can't tell you how many people I've talked to that want to start a nonprofit, that want to volunteer their time, you know, because I think that psilocybin, okay, we had a cannabis like surplus. Mushrooms go a lot further. One person could consume a pound of weed in a year if you smoked 3 grams a day every day.
You've done the math.
Yeah, you could smoke 3 grams a day every day. Whether you could smoke blunts with your friends, 1 gram blunts with your friends. It's easy. I've done it. You can do that very easily. And if you ate 3 grams of mushrooms every day for a year, you'd be fried.
Right.
You'd be totally fried. So I don't suggest that even a little bit. Some people need 2-3 gram, you know, sessions or trips in a year. And that's it. You just need 2 regulatory things. Boom, you're off your antidepressants if that's what works for your system. Right. But my point being, we're going to have a lot of mushrooms. There's going to be a lot of mushrooms. So the mushrooms, I don't think, are going to be the expensive aspect of it. No. It's finding a person who's going to take their time to do something. And so you don't expect your therapist to work for free. So your therapist talks to you for 30 minutes or an hour, and they sometimes get $80 depending on your health insurance.
Right.
This person's going to sit with you for hours.
Right.
And then help you integrate pre and post integration. So they definitely should be compensated. What they should be compensated, I'm not too sure. And yeah.
Well, I'm so glad that you brought this up. So we're going to go down a mini business viability rabbit hole, and I'm going to connect it back to affordability and equity. So yeah. I talk to so many people reach out to me on a weekly basis saying, you know, mostly a lot of them from the cannabis industry, like, I want to grow mushrooms. I'm like, okay, cool. Why do you want to grow mushrooms? It's like, because everyone's going to take them. I'm like, cool. Have you ever grown mushrooms or done them? Because clearly you haven't. Because if you did, you'd know that like you and me could grow enough mushrooms in this closet to supply the entire state of Oregon for a year.
Yeah.
Like that. Like if you're actually looking to do this for like a profit model, like producing mushrooms ain't it.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that providing the services is it either. Like if you're looking to get rich, like maybe you want to look elsewhere.
Oh yeah.
For several reasons, like that being a main one. But another one is that I think a lot of the companies that are starting to exist in this space right now don't understand, especially the ones that came from cannabis, don't understand that, you know, for cannabis, it's like bag appeal, it's smell, it's price point, it's look, it's sticky, you know, there's all these attributes, right? Because it's retail, right? And it's just, that's part of the things that make up like good versus bad cannabis versus everything in between, right? They're applying that type of logic to psilocybin, and it just doesn't compute. Not only does it not compute, but what they don't understand is that their reputation in providing services and how they provide them, and more importantly, who they're providing them to and at what cost. It is what is going to be reflected in the history books of their business. And if they jump out of the gate and they're not proactive in talking about how they're going to serve populations that stand to benefit greatly from accessing this, but without their help, they're not going to be able to. Like, I'm keeping a list.
Oh, yeah.
Of these companies who are calling me for interviews who I never heard of during the campaign. And that's fine, right? Like, just because you didn't have anything to do with the campaign doesn't mean you don't deserve, you know, a meeting or like to learn more about it, and doesn't mean that you're not willing and able to do good things. There are certainly those people. 9 out of 10 of them just looking to make a buck. And if you're out there listening, like, hear me tell you that we are paying attention, and you need to understand that if you want to run a good business, you can run a good business and make good money doing the right thing, putting people first. And I think that is one of the main determining factors of who will be successful and who is going to be outed by the community for just being here for money. And I hope that that happens so quick.
Yeah.
And if you can, I mean, I'm doing everything I can to like help make it happen, but I'm just one person. But I do think that people really have a lot to learn. There's going to be a crash course in what people care about, especially here in Oregon, right? Like, you know, when it comes time for me to go to my first psilocybin preparation session at a licensed service center, I will not make an appointment with anyone who has not laid out a clear mission of what they're doing to help serve like our BIPOC, economically depressed, you know, communities here in Oregon. Like, that's how I'm going to choose my service provider. What are you doing for the people who cannot afford this service like I can? And how are you encouraging me to help that work?
Absolutely.
Right? Like, is there a way for me to tack on extra dollars to my session to help someone else have their own session? Right? You know, are you setting aside slots for certain people? What other organizations are you working with? Right? If you think you're going to do this on your own and like you can start it from scratch because you think it's never been done before, think again. Like,
oh yeah.
You know, there's a whole larger conversation that we also still need to have, which I expect is very much going to happen over the next 2 years, which really doesn't have anything to do with psilocybin. It has to do with, okay, if we're talking about serving, you know, BIPOC communities, we need to talk about who it is that is going to be serving them best. It ain't a bunch of white dudes.
Nope.
Why would you trust them? I wouldn't if I were you.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that it's really important that we, again, step back and like acknowledge, you know, the massive amount of privilege that exists in this conversation and continue to create and make space for people that want to drive the conversation about what equity and access looks like. Like, sure, I've got a couple ideas. We had a healthcare equity committee that was primarily made up of BIPOC community individuals, et cetera. And we plan to really like expand that in a big way to set a table and step back and say, we care. We want to help. We want to compensate you for helping us figure this out.
Yeah.
And like, let's do this right. And let's not pretend like the white dude's got the answers, because we don't at the end of the day. And that's a lot of what I had to tell people during the campaign was like, look, like I'm passionate about this. Like, I have experience in writing equitable cannabis policies for different cities. I used to sit on the policy committee for the Minority Cannabis Business Association. Not my first rodeo. And because it's not my first rodeo, I understand the importance of me stepping back and simply allowing other people to drive that conversation. And again, to make sure that they're compensated for it. That's one of the 9 times out of 10, that's one of the things that people don't understand. It's like, okay, like let's have the people of color lead this conversation because they're the people of color. And it's like, cool, you can do that. And that's not a bad idea. But if you think that they should do it for free, you're really missing the point.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's like figuring out what you can do and what role you can play in all of this. Because again, like I don't have the answers. You know what I mean? Like, all I know is that I want to help make this equitable for everyone. And what I can do with that is share information, shine a light on it, educate people the best that I can, and have conversations. You know what I mean? Like have tough conversations sometimes, or be able to address this head on and not like try to look the other way, or you know what I mean? Like, I don't pretend like, you know, that, whatever, you know, some folks just don't want to talk about this kind of stuff. You know, it makes them uncomfortable, right? Or they don't have the vocabulary. They don't want to say the wrong thing.
Yep.
They have the best intentions, but don't want to, especially in Portland, say the wrong thing and have the community like freak out on them, you know? And so I think a lot of people are afraid to be misunderstood. And I think a lot of people currently have been triggered by things that are going on in our country where they're a little bit more sensitive. And so I think that sometimes there's kind of have an issue there when we're not creating a space where it's like, hey, we're going to have a space where we're going to have a discussion. And just so everyone knows, everyone that has showed up here has the best intentions. And if somebody says something weird, like, let's correct each other and check one another. And instead of calling somebody out, call them in.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a good argument to be made that it's harder for a lot of people to do right now because it's such a politically charged environment, right? Everything's so delicate. We're all walking on glass to some degree. And that's why it's more important now than ever that we have these conversations and that, you know, even if it feels like a risk to trust someone else, that's why you should give them the benefit of the doubt and just try it out. Even if you get proof wrong, like it's going to happen too, right? Like that's how building community and like trust works, is that you have to take a little bit of risk. And if you do it enough, it's going to pay off. And I really think that, you know, that's what is going to make the future of an equitable program a reality, is it's not just the community coming and, you know, getting involved. It's not just going to be funders. It's not just going to be the state. It's not just going to be the insurance companies and the providers and the facilitators and people who disagree and agree with us, right? It's everyone. Every single one of those people has to play a part for this to become a reality. We cannot leave out any part of the equation, even if they're the people that gave us the broken healthcare system we have now. Like, they also have to be involved in this conversation, because guess what? I'm sure as hell not going to let this be a broken psilocybin therapy session. I'm sure you're not either, Joe.
Yeah, I won't, man. I can't let it. I can't have gotten this involved and said as many words as I did. I've got to take action to follow up my words. And that's so important right now. Do the things that you say and don't say what you don't mean. So, you know, and again, like you said, I don't know how I have an idea of what I want to be done, which is to allow affordable care for everybody, regardless of race, gender, how they present themselves and how they identify themselves. Everyone deserves to be treated the same. And what I can do is I can talk about it. I can build my platform, which is my podcast. I can have guests on in the community. I'd love to know more individuals in the BIPOC community or in the psychedelic community who would love to talk about this. This podcast is your platform. I'm building a platform for other people to talk, and I can step back and let people come on here and say what they need to say, so people can hear it. We can all come together. We can educate one another, and we can do it gracefully and respectfully, you know. And that's what I have to contribute to this, is my time, my attention, my effort, and my platform is your platform, you know.
Yeah.
So, and. Yeah, and so I'm excited to see how this continues to move forward. So I had a question, because this is something that's come up in some of the groups as far as who is allowed to become somebody who can facilitate these experiences.
Yep.
Could you maybe talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, definitely. So several years ago when I met Tom and Sheree 3.5 years ago. I went to one of their soirees, as Tom calls them, back when they still lived out in Beaverton. And, you know, got to really know Tom and Sheree and their vision. And when Tom and Sheree kind of shared their vision with me initially, you know, as like someone who's been in the political policy trenches for a long time, I'm like, oh, wow, like this is a hell of a vision to allow people to be psilocybin facilitators without necessarily requiring them to be having a therapist license or any type of medical license. That's awesome. And how the hell are we going to pass that?
Yeah.
That was my first question, to be honest, right? And it just goes to show how long and how much time and effort and love and energy Tom and Sheree put into this thing. Because guess what? Not only do we do it, we did it big, 56%, right? So for those who don't know, Measure 109 actually forbids the Oregon Health Authority from ever requiring any type of medical license or degree in order to become a licensed facilitator. Now, luckily, we didn't have any real serious organized or well-funded opposition, because if we did, they would have taken that and ran with it, right? You know, and so, you know, why? Why not require that type of license? Why not require people to be therapists, right? Outside of, you know, some of the obvious reasons that there are plenty of people who are more than capable of doing these types of sessions that need no degree, right? Mm-hmm. Just because you are an ER doctor who's been practicing for 30 years does not mean you know anything about psilocybin, right? Or psychedelics in general, or spiritual or mystical experiences for that matter, right?
No, probably very science-based people.
Right. And just because you've been doing amazing underground work for the last 30 years does not necessarily mean that you have any type of ethical or moral training in providing services to people.
Yeah.
Right. So we, yeah. You know, there's horror stories on both ends of that spectrum for sure.
Yeah.
And so least. Tom and Cherie really made a bold decision to create this new path in the middle to say that there is room for people on both ends of that spectrum to participate in a program that is really, it's therapy focused. But when we say therapy, we don't mean therapy in the sense of talk therapy, where like you're really working with a therapist, like externalizing, they're repeating back, like it's a dialogue, right? For those of you who maybe haven't had, you know, a more formal type of experience with a facilitator or any kind of psychedelic experience, psilocybin is simply the tool. You're the one doing the work at the end of the day in the actual session, right? And so, you know, we've seen throughout thousands of years of history that in the right context, with the right preparation and the right setting and the right integration afterwards, that you don't need to be an MD to be able to provide comfort and safety and those kinds of things, right?
Yeah.
Now, there's a lot of specific points in here. Like, for example, if you want to be a facilitator for people who are on or have been on anti-anxiety medication or anti-depression medication, you're probably going to need a background in that. I don't think if I was on anti-anxiety medication, I don't think I would want to sit with someone who doesn't have some type of credentials in that. Maybe not necessarily a degree, but like I need to feel good about the fact that like what I'm doing here, like you understand how these things mix or don't mix together, right?
Yeah.
So I do very much envision there being variation. There's going to be like a bare minimum standard, right? Which is probably going to be more than just a bare minimum, right? It's not going to be a 20 question multiple choice quiz and you get your facilitator's license, right? Like it's going to be some work, but it's not going to be you need to go to college for 4 years type of thing, or two even necessarily. Like I couldn't tell you exactly what that training, you know, course and certification is going to be, but I can tell you that the Oregon Health Authority has the final say on it, and they're not going to go light on it, right?
No.
And so that's you know, it presents potential problems within the opportunity as well, right? Like this very delicate balance of making sure that we are putting client and patient safety first while simultaneously ensuring that this is still affordable, accessible, and equitable. Like that is so much easier said than done. And that's exactly, again, why we have to put our money where our mouth is and do this hard work. We're going to have some really hard conversations. There's going to be some people that have never seen themselves in the mirror before until this process.
Yeah.
And we're bringing the mirrors.
yeah, absolutely. I mean, psilocybin itself is a mirror and exactly. I think also too, I love that that's written in there because if it wasn't, it would just be creating another barrier, you know?
That's right.
Like I'm sure obviously the Oregon loves to certify people in things. They really do. They love their certificates and they like, you know, the money that comes with them too. But at the same time, like I'm a certified unarmed security guard. When you go to the Crystal Ballroom or any music venue, every single person in there has a card and you have the right to ask them to see their card at any point in time to make sure that it's valid. Mm. And then the people you see at other places who are carrying firearms had to go to a very the guy who taught my class was like, if you have a gun and you want to be an armed security guard, don't do it. Mm. Like legitimately don't do it. It's like, it's a really hard, expensive, like you don't want to do it. You know, if you don't have to, like, don't get it just to have it. Like he's like, unless you have some kind of job where you need it. So you do have to get certified with things in Oregon. And again, it is better to have somebody who is certified in something. And hopefully what we can do is set up some kind of fundraising opportunities for people who, you know, depending on how much this is going to cost, we should be able to set up fundraising opportunities to get people who can't afford whatever, I don't want to say schooling, but whatever it's going to cost and we're going to have to do to get qualified and certified, we should be able to fundraise for individuals too. And that's something that I would love to also get involved with. So.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought that up, right? Because when we talk about equity within the sense of psilocybin therapy, it's not just equity and access. Like I that's incredibly important, right? It's just as important that we're talking about equity and licensing,
mm-hmm.
right? And that huge lessons we learned from mm-hmm. cannabis in that, right? We had so many opportunities to prioritize folks of color having an opportunity to get involved with this industry, many of which still doing time for cannabis related crimes, right? Like we're making slow progress, but like it's not fast enough. And we really missed the boat in a lot of different ways. And so, you know, every opportunity that we have moving forward, to pause and say, hey, is this something that we should really be thinking about from an equity perspective? We're going to take that opportunity, right? And licensing is a huge one, right? And again, it really gets back to, what are we going, like, we could create all the equitable licensing regulations in the world. If, you know, zero, you know, folks of color or people from the BIPOC community apply for those positions, it was all a waste of time.
Yeah.
Right. So again, it just goes back to the importance of including and centering them in this conversation, empowering them in whatever ways that we can to give them what they need to help us create a program that is actually equitable and accessible. And again, I've said it before and I'll say it again. It's easier said than done. We've got our work cut out for us, but that's exactly why it's worth doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we'll be able to, I'm hopeful. I'm very hopeful. You know, the week before the week before this passed, and actually is the second episode of my podcast, I talked to Charlotte, you know, about all of this. And so thanks again for Charlotte for coming on and talking to me when you were so busy. And Sam, I'm happy that we waited until now, because we get to be on the other side of this, and it's kind of like a follow-up. So this is really awesome. I'm happy we were able to do this follow-up podcast and kind of maybe address questions that folks might be having around how this is going to be implemented, the whole licensing aspect of it, how we are going to try to make it equitable, getting folks to get involved, doing education. And so with the Healing Advocacy Fund, what other stuff are you working on with them, or what other kind of projects, I guess, do you?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's really all eyes on Oregon, right? So again, so rulemaking and, you know, working with the Oregon Health Authority and everyone on that board is paramount, right? You know, the other thing that I mentioned before, which is, you know, not nearly as exciting, is like getting that allocated funding from the legislature, right? We kind of got to get in and out, but it's a budgetary item. So it's going to take the entire legislative session. So I've hired a lobbyist already who's very well known in the building, has a lot of street cred, and, you know, very excited to get this program funded. The other item in my portfolio, which is pretty small, but could rapidly expand, and it kind of already is rapidly expanding, is, you know, I get emails every single day from people in other states, other cities, other countries around the world that, like, we want to do this, right? And so the interesting thing, and the part of it that makes it fun for me as like a policy nerd, is that every one of those states, cities, or countries is starting from a different place. And so while our model is certainly one to strive for, not everyone is necessarily going to want to start with where we started, right? Maybe they need to win some local battles first, or maybe they need to neutralize some opposition that stands to kill anything they do, or maybe they live in a place to where they can, like, go to the next step.
Yeah.
Right. The next step forward. And maybe it's not just psilocybin. Maybe it's MDMA. Maybe it's LSD as well. Right. Like, you know, I think that there's a lot of opportunities based on geographic region and what the political climate is in your state, country, city, or region. And so it's really fun to get to meet these people, a lot of which I met during the campaign. I'm meeting even more now, and really help them understand how we did what we did here in Oregon. And you know, regardless of where they are or what the climate is, there's always a foundational basis that our campaign really lived on and won on. And there's four primary elements that we learned that when you can convey these points to people in a short amount of time, you can get them to at least understand why this might be valuable for someone else, not necessarily themselves, but for someone that they know and love. And those points are, number one, what is psilocybin? big surprise. Number two, what is the research showing around psilocybin right now, right? Talking about all the different studies, talking about the fact that we've had studies on safety and efficacy on the books for like 40 or 50 years, talking about the fact that despite the fact that psilocybin is still technically a Schedule I drug at the federal level, that the FDA, a federal agency, has given breakthrough therapy status for psilocybin for major depressive disorder and treatment-resistant depression. Right?
Twice.
Yeah, twice. Exactly. Twice. Yeah. Really points out the hypocrisy that Schedule I for psilocybin, or most of these drugs, is not a scientific scheduling. It's a political one, right?
Yeah.
So, and then number three, what does Measure 109 do And sometimes, more importantly, depending on the audience you're talking to, what does it not do, right? We're not talking about retail sales. Like, this isn't going to be in, like, Whole Foods where you're going to just go buy an ounce of mushrooms and go home, right? Yeah. We might get in that part of the conversation. I don't think it'll ever get that way. I'm not opposed to the general model, but, like, you know, could be some serious blowback if we get there too fast in all reality. But what is it that you're doing and what is it not doing, right? And then last but not least, who stands to benefit from having access, right? And that's where you really get to put people in their own shoes to a certain degree, right? You get to help them understand their mother, their grandmother, right? People that they love and care about might stand to really benefit. And that psilocybin therapy isn't for everyone necessarily, right? There's plenty of people that are perfectly happy and that prescription daily pills work great, right? And we are not interested in like challenging that. Why would we, right? If something's working, great.
Yeah.
And we know, especially now with the pandemic, according to the CDC, 1 in 3 Americans are experiencing clinical symptoms of depression and anxiety, right? And here in Oregon, the problem is even more acute. Prior to COVID, we were ranked with the most severe mental health crisis in the country by Mental Health America. That was prior to COVID. And so the rate at which people are suffering is continuing to unfortunately be astronomical. And so it's incredibly timely that we're able to introduce this here in Oregon and generally into society in a way that it wasn't really taken seriously before. And so really excited to continue to work on this, provide new opportunities for folks where the current available alternatives have fallen short.
Yeah. I mean, again, you're saying treatment resistant depression. So these folks have tried pharmaceutical drugs. They've probably tried some form of cognitive behavioral therapy.
Shock therapy. I met many people who went through shock therapy. That's, like, as children, they were put through shock therapy.
That's sad. I don't want to say someone's experience is sad, but it's a bummer that those are the things that the tools, I guess, we had at the time that we were thought. I mean,
anyone thought that was acceptable?
We used to lobotomies are real. They lobotomized people. You know, it's wild. Not to say that folks who are suffering from what would seem to be severe mental health symptoms need psychedelics, but like there should definitely, we just don't, I don't think we understand it. And honestly, that's what got me on this whole path is dealing with family members in my family that have dealt with mental health issues. My mom and myself included, I've taken Zoloft at one point in my time. I've taken Seroquel. Seroquel is it didn't work well for me. I'm not going to say it's a horrible drug because maybe it's working for somebody out there, but it did not work well for me. And I ended up, after taking that, ended up having a psychosis episode brought on by it. And it wasn't until I had taken LSD after that, I almost freaked out. And then when I got over the hump, it completely reset my brain. And from that point on, I think it was like June of 2013. I've dealt with psychosis before. I know what that feels like, and to feel dissociated in your own body, it felt like I was watching my life from like 3 inches behind my own eyes, which is not very fun. And so I've experienced that and come out of that. So again, like, and this is me playing, I don't want to say doctor, but me doing this within my own self and with my own autonomy over my own body. And so I very much think that people it shouldn't be illegal for people to do that. But at the same time, I definitely have put myself into places mentally that could have not been great for me. And so having a community to talk to and having licensed people or people who are experienced in this, in that, you know, they've been doing this since the 60s. There's a lot of people have been doing this underground. And so thank you to Albert Hoffman. I think it's his birthday today.
Today or yesterday. I'm not sure, but yeah.
Yeah. So thank you to Albert Hoffman for that lovely accident and creating your problem child. And thank you for all of the other Alexander Shulgin and all these amazing people who've done in Marina Sabina and the indigenous communities, everybody who's helped to bring this medicine. And there's been a lot of people that have been put in jail who are in jail for just trying to do their part in this whole thing. And so I just want to say thank you to those folks and people who continue to spread truth and knowledge out there for individuals. But just, you know, with, I can only speak on behalf of my own experience and in my own life. And so I just think that it's my duty to some degree to be able to provide people with having to be able to choose for themselves if something's going to work for them or not. And they need to be educated so they can know and make a well-informed decision instead of just being like, oh, I heard online that some people do this and it could be something that could be detrimental for them. So having having like a community and some guidelines and some guides that are there to be able to provide information to people so they can make a well-informed decision of whether something's going to be enough for them. And also being able to speak about dosing too. Not all psilocybin mushrooms are created equal. There's some of them are way more potent than others. And also, you know, some information out there, people trying to tell you to eat 7 grams of mushrooms is really not a great idea and can definitely have a not positive effect on you too. So that's the other thing too, is being able to tell the truth, which is like, again, you know, not everything is beneficial for everybody. You wouldn't tell a person who's allergic to nuts to eat peanuts. It might kill them.
Right.
So, you know, I've got an almond sensitivity. I shouldn't eat almonds, you know? So again, not everything works for everybody.
Right. So. Well, it's such a great point. I mean, I feel like, you know, people like you and I are incredibly lucky, right? Like that.
Yeah.
We were brought into this sphere with probably like friends, right? That like, that were able to bring us along in the education that we had. And even then we can still screw it up for ourselves.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's not a privilege to be taken lightly to be able to have a freedom to put whatever you want in your body.
No.
Right. Again, that back to that SSDP model is incredibly important that like you have the freedom to put what you want in your body. And so long as you're educated and you're not harming other people, then you should be able to do it. That education piece,
yeah,
it's a big word. And I think a lot of people take it for granted that they think that everyone's already educated and that like you should like, oh, you never done mushrooms? Like you should grow them yourself or you should go pick them and then you should do them. Or like, you know, here's a YouTube video. It's like, okay, sure. Maybe for a very small segment of the population, that'll work. But even with them, there's still a risk, right? And that's not to take that away from the people that has worked for, right? The people that has worked for has helped us get to where we are today.
Yep.
To think that that model applies to every single person that stands to benefit from psilocybin is crazy. I'm sorry. Like, you're going to tell a terminally ill cancer patient to go out to a cow pasture and pick psilocybin mushrooms and like look up a YouTube, like, sorry, like, you know, there needs to be some infrastructure for the larger amount of people that are never going to feel comfortable accessing through an underground model. It's against the law.
Yeah.
It's- and sure, there's plenty of people willing to break the law, but like, you know how many more people stand like would access this if it wasn't illegal and there was a program and they felt good about the training and they could look up, there's accountability for these facilitators should they do something unethical. Right? Like, we're talking about providing as much access to as many people as possible that stand to benefit, not just people who are familiar and are willing to do something on their own, right? That's not to take that away from them. Never. Not, of course not, right? Mm-hmm. Again, we wouldn't be here without that. But it's incredibly important that people understand that, like, if we're really collectively talking about helping as many people as possible, there's a different paradigm in which that has to evolve into for that access to really be possible. And we have to be careful that it doesn't become too burdensome.
Right? Yeah.
And this is that catch-22 delicate dance that we're going to be doing over the next 2 years.
Absolutely. You know, let me ask you this. What does a person who takes psilocybin mushrooms look like?
It's a good question. They come in all shapes and sizes and forms and colors and smells, yeah, and you know,
exactly. That's the, it's mushrooms aren't just for hippies. Mushrooms just aren't for the spiritually conscious. Mushrooms are for everybody that is willing, that is interested and willing and stands to benefit. That's my point I'm trying to make. Yep. You know, like what does a drug user look like? What does an alcoholic look like? What does anything look like? It's an image in our mind, and we have these projections we put onto people all the time.
Yep.
And so what we need to do, or what I'm trying to do here is to say that this everybody, any and everybody can stand to benefit from this. The community is made up of everybody, and no one's going to, if you want to be included, welcome. You have found your community, you know. I think that there's too, like, we're out of high school, man. I'm not involved with clicky stuff anymore. Like, I think it's really important to open up the dialogue to everyone, to open the door to everyone. No question around this is a silly question. So,
right.
You know, and I think, you know, creating more content and things that people can interact with will really help as we can continue to create more educational tools. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Well, that being said, so how, if people are curious or they want to get involved or they want to know more, what is the best way to do that?
Yeah. So again, I don't have the URL in front of me, but I imagine if you Google Oregon Health Authority psilocybin program, you will pretty quickly find the OHA website where you can sign up for newsletters. That's the first thing. That's from the horse's mouth. They're the ones that are going to be announcing who the committee schedule, all that stuff. You'll probably hear about who gets selected for the board from the governor, which will probably be news. So expect to just like see that in the news probably. But first and foremost, sign up for that email newsletter. Like, that's where I'm going to be paying attention. That's where you should be paying attention. Everyone should be getting that newsletter regardless of what, you know, part of this program you're interested in participating in. And the second thing I've been encouraging people to really think about is, what do you specifically uniquely have to bring to the table? Is it an experience? Is it a service? Is it a certification? Is it a community? Is it a perspective, right? We all, whether we know it or not, many people don't know exactly what that is, right? So easier said than done, right? But think about it, like really sit with yourself. Like, what is it that I uniquely can bring to the table, and then bring it to the table? Right. And, yeah. and if you're curious about what that is, you know, again, it's funny how many people reach out to me and, you know, I definitely have like a vetting system, but like, if you ever had anything to do with Measure 109, my time is yours. Like, at the end of the day, you know, if you're interested in, you know, creating an equitable, accessible program, you're interested in bringing BIPOC communities to the table, like, I want to meet with you. Like, I want to get on your calendar, actually. Right. And So please, like, don't hesitate to reach out. My email is sam@healingadvocacyfund.org. Definitely please give me a couple of days to respond. I'm still reeling in from emails from the campaign. But you know, I'm happy to work with you. And I think, you know, you also don't need, I'm not the answer. I'm just one guy who has a little bit more information than the average person right now. That's going to change pretty quickly. We're all going to be on the same level of information moving forward. And that's why it's so important that we continue to like bring community and perspective and new voices to the table that are not there now. And so I really just encourage people to really look inwards about, you know, what it is that they have to offer and those experiences, because the future of our program depends on it.
Yeah, absolutely. And cool. Yeah. So folks, yeah, if you want to reach out to Sam, I'm also going to include the information in the description of the podcast as well. So we'll get those links for you guys to click if you want to be more informed and get involved with this. And so, Sam, I've got one more question for you, and that is, what would you like to upload to the Conscious Cloud?
If you're feeling down and out about the current situation right now, if you're feeling overly burdened with the current state of society, locally, statewide, nationally, internationally, we're with you. We're all in this together. And it can be incredibly hard, if not sometimes impossible, to ignore the pessimism and the negativity in the world right now. But I want to challenge you to really focus in on the things that are positive, the opportunities, right? And the silver linings is a huge word that's thrown around all the time right now. And I think for sometimes good reasons, sometimes bad reasons. But there are opportunities to shift our focus, to shift our consciousness towards positive outcomes, not just for ourselves, but for everyone, for humanity as a whole. And I really think that, you know, that's embodied in Measure 109, right? That's embodied in all kinds of different movements in the social and racial justice movements that are exploding right now at such a great rate, you know? And, you know, whether it's with Measure 109 or not, like, what do you have to bring to the table? What comes naturally, right? What's the thing that when you overhear a conversation and you just can't not go over and be like, hey, I'm sorry I overheard that, but like, I got it. Like, I want to be part of this, right? Like, follow your excitement, right? Because it can be such a rare thing these days, but when you see it, grab it, hold on to it, and never forget where it came from. Because I think it's easy to lose sight in times of turmoil and pain and suffering, which a lot of us are going through right now. And that's going to continue to happen. I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. And so being able to have that shift in consciousness and really focus on the things that matter to you. And chances are, if you're listening to this podcast, the things that matter to you probably matter to other people too. You care.
Yeah.
Right? So don't stop caring and don't ever stop asking yourself, what can I do? Because there's always an answer on the other side of that equation.
Beautiful, Sam. Thank you for taking time and coming by to do this podcast. I think it's going to provide people with a lot of lovely information and hopefully make some people's hearts warm too. So,
well, thanks again for having me, Joe. I look forward to seeing the Consciousness Cloud on the top 10 podcast list in the next couple of months here.
Yeah.
Hopefully you'll still have me back at that point.
Yeah. Hopefully.
You might be too cool for school. We'll see.
Yeah. No, man. I can't wait to check in with you a couple months from now. And I can't wait to check in with you 2 years from now when this thing comes to fruition and we get to see the first legal psilocybin assisted therapy session and dose given out to the very deserving person that it's going to go to. So, again, thank you, Cherie, for your vision and your time and your energy and your spirit. And, hopefully we'll do a good job carrying the torch here. So yeah. Thanks, Sam.
Thanks, Jeff.
I really love Sam's contribution to the Conscious Cloud. If I had to reduce it a little bit, boil it down, it would be follow your excitement. What is the thing that lights you up? What is the thing that makes your heart beat? You know, like he said, when you overhear a conversation about it, you just want to go and join in. It is just the thing that gets you so excited. You know, what is that? Think about it and follow it. You know, if you imagine that you have a garden and you're growing things in this garden and the water is attention and energy. And the more you continue to water things, the more they grow. You know, what would you like to have in your garden? You know, would you like to have more fear? Because I feel the more we focus on the things that we don't want, we focus on them, we water them with our attention, and they continue to grow. So it's time to pull the weeds out of the garden, get them out of here, throw them in the compost pile, because they do have a place. They have to go get turned back into usable soil somewhere, right? And just let them return. Get rid of it. Let it return. Turn back into love. Turn back into excitement. And so find the things that you want to grow in your life garden. You know, Jack Kornfield has a quote, and I love it very much. It's, tend to the part of the garden that you can touch. And those are your relationships. It's everything that's around you in the present moment. And so, you know, find the things that you're passionate about, and, you know, whether it's like making music, making a podcast, talking to individuals, making poetry, you know, playing with dogs. I don't know. Whatever it happens to be, just you know, focus on that. And things are kind of tough right now, but at the same time, we can also look at it from a different perspective and just say, you know, we're going through growing pains as we continue to evolve. You know, I love those the spiritual memes where it's like what you think conscious or what you think a spiritual life looks like, and it's like all like rainbows and bliss or whatever, and then and angels, and then it's like what an actual spiritual life's like, and it's like a Hieronymus Bosch painting that just it looks like hell almost. There's just like all this shit's going on, and because that's spiritual growth. It's not all sunshine and rainbows. You know, another quote I like too. Wayne Coyne said it at a Flaming Lips show, and it's, you know, it takes a lot of rain to make a rainbow. So, you know, the silver lining of the rain is the rainbow. So let's try to find the rainbows. And when it is raining in life, let's remember that you need rain, you need water to have the plants grow and keep Oregon a beautiful, lush place. And also the rain brings the rainbow. So that being said, if you want more information, the link is too long for me to say and confusing, so I'm just going to leave it in the description of the podcast. If you want to go check out the OHA website, you can also look up Oregon Health Authority, I think like psilocybin, just Google that and it should come up. But again, in the description, I'll have a link that you can click. If you want to check out the Measure 109 Instagram, it's at Vote Yes on 109. There's updates that get posted there as well. And if you want to check out the Portland Psychedelic Society, I believe it's portlandpsychedelicsociety.org. My website is going to be theconsciouscloud.org. I'm currently working on getting that up and running, and so I'll have updates there. You can find me at The Conscious Cloud on Instagram and Facebook as well. If you want to reach out and connect and get involved, we would love to hear from you. If this podcast has resonated with you and you are feeling called to action, we can all bring something to the table here. And yep, check out the Fruiting Bodies podcast. Shout out again to Becca and Alon. Check out the Medicine Collective. They've got cool stuff going on there, and we've got some cool stuff in the works. I am so excited. The mycelial bonds are spreading, and our guilds are getting stronger as we continue to build this beautiful community. Obviously, already an amazing community here, but hopefully this summer we can do some fun, safe, socially distanced activities together. Also, in case anybody's wondering, the podcast that I've been doing, we've been following the rules. We've been staying masked until we actually record the episodes. We're staying socially distant as well. If that's something you're wondering about, there's only two individuals in the area where the podcasts are being recorded. I've obviously done some of these remote as well, trying to be as mindful as possible and as safe as possible when doing this. You know, but yeah, just the life has to move on, and we've all got to do our part and, you know, be safe. So in case anybody's wondering, I just want to put that information out there as well. So thank you guys for listening to today's episode. If you have Apple Podcasts, if you want to subscribe. And if you want to leave a good rating, it would be much appreciated. It helps get the podcast some visibility. And yeah, until next time, folks, be the frequency you want to see. Be the frequency you want to see. I love you all.